Well, brothers and sisters, Brother Jason Hensley will be delivering the fifth class in his morning class series this evening in order to facilitate him leaving the Midwest Bible School on Friday afternoon. And the theme for Brother Hensley's classes this week is the beginning of Christ's story. Today's class is entitled Anna, the Jason. Evening, everyone. I'd like to draw your attention to two things as we start. The first is I'd like to thank you because I know how precious schedules are. So I want to thank you for being flexible with yours and allowing me to do my last class my second to last tonight. So thank you for that. And I'd also like you to take a look at your watch and notice it is only 7:05. Now, do you know when this is supposed to end? 8 o'clock. 9. That's right. I forgot. So we can actually get through all the slides. So there we go. Okay. Now, once again, the slides are available for you. Be ready. Here we go. Class number 5. We're talking about Anna. 3 parts, as you have perhaps come to expect. We're going to talk about the story of Anna first. Then we are going to talk about Anna and trust. So Anna and trust. Now, for me, this was really exciting looking at this trust piece because if you read the story of Anna, there's really not a ton there just immediately. It's just a handful of verses about who she is, where she's at, and how she is in the temple fasting and praying. So we're going to break down a little bit of this and try and understand some more who she is. And that's where we're going to see this trust piece. Then we're going to talk about Anna as a widow. Because I think that shows up later in the New Testament. So that's the plan. Our main message now, I see this as a progression. So we've recognized the way that grace is so essential. We've been able to see that. We've been able to see the importance of pondering God's ways and of recognizing the exceptionality of the Lord Jesus. Right, so we've been able to see all of these various things that have come together in our main messages. And now, when we recognize that, we want to say, well, what does that compel me to do? When we see that God has created another way, that God has broken out into the world to bring this salvation that Simeon looked upon, what does that cause us to do? And what God looks for isn't blamelessness. That's what he does. Right? He makes us blameless. Instead, what he looks for is people that trust him. People that trust him. So that's our main message. God looks for exceptional trust. And I'm going to suggest to you that Anna was exceptional. Now, the question is why? How do we know? What is it about her that really shows her as exceptional? So let's go through it. Now, let's take a look. Okay. Anybody know? This is the temple. Yes. Anybody know what court this is? Yes, this is the court of the women. All right. So we're going to be talking a little bit about the court of the women. We want to try and envision this whole scene. Now, we already talked about Simeon today. We're also going to try and envision when that happened. We didn't talk specifically about it. So as we work through this, we're going to try and picture how this took place, when Simeon met them, when Anna met them, and really where they were even going in the temple. Right? So we want to get all of that in our minds. Here's the Anna section. As I said, it's not very long. This is it. There was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was advanced in years, having lived with her husband 7 years from when she was a virgin. And then as a widow until she was 84, she did not depart from the temple, worshiping with fasting and prayer night and day. And coming up at that very hour, she began to give thanks to God and to speak of him to all who were waiting for the redemption of Jerusalem. So this is what we know about Anna. Again, simple, to the point, but there's so much here that we can learn about who she was. Before we do that, though, we're going to try and understand actually where she was. So take a look at this. As we already talked about, you have the Court of the Women. If you can see it, that's marked as number 7 on the screen. So what you're looking at here is a diagram of Herod's temple. The part that I have outlined in blue, that is what was known as the Court of the Gentiles. Now, within the Court of the Gentiles, I've marked this in green, there was a section that you couldn't go past if you were a Gentile. So the Court of the Gentiles, it was called that because you were allowed to be there if you were a Gentile, but you couldn't go past that green section. Now, we know this historically. It actually comes up in the book of Acts as well. Anybody know where? It's Trophimus the Ephesian. Right? Okay, so it's Trophimus the Ephesian. People think that Paul brings him into that section, right? And so this is part of what causes Paul's arrest in Jerusalem, right? They say, this man brought Gentiles into the temple, and so this is why he's arrested. So we know historically as well, because there's actually multiple stones that have been found. They're written in Greek, only Greek, in all capital Greek, and it says, do not pass this line. If you do, you will be responsible for your own death, which will ensue. And that's pretty, you know, like, those are the kind of signs that you don't want to read, like when you're traveling in a place with foreign language, like written up there, right? So, you know, that was what was posted there. So you were not, if you were a Gentile, you were totally welcome to be on that platform, but you could not get that close to the temple. The temple was seen as a very holy place. You don't get near there, which, by the way, is the reason why Orthodox Jews still won't go on the Temple Mount platform, right? So there's this sense that it is so holy that we don't actually know where certain things were. This is what they say. So they feel that if they go too close to where the most holy place was, they might accidentally step on it, right? And then that would be bad. So there was this feeling of sanctity about the temple. If you were a Gentile, you couldn't go there. Now then, the Court of the Women, as you can probably figure this out, was the area where generally women hung out because there was a division. And again, still today, there is a division in Orthodox Jewish congregations, even at the Western Wall, right? If you go there, it's divided into men and women. So the Court of the Women was where the women were allowed to go. And within that, number 3, that's called the Court of Israel. And at the Court of Israel, you could go into there if you were a male, and then you could go beyond that as a priest. So that was the way that things were set up. Therefore, when we're looking at this area, probably what happens is Simeon meets them first. And it sounds, when you read the Luke record, it sounds as though Simeon was walking to the temple. So he probably meets them maybe on the steps up to the temple, maybe in the Court of the Gentiles. And then Anna is likely in the Court of the Women. And so they're on their way in the Court of the Women into the Court of the Israelites, where Joseph and Mary, she is allowed at this point because they're offering an offering, where Joseph and Mary are going to offer this offering at the altar. Okay, so here's all the passages to bring them together here. You can see it in verse 27. He, that's Simeon, came in the spirit into the temple, and when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him according to the custom of the law. So that's Simeon coming in. You have Anna, right? And then, verse 39, you have, they offer their offering, then they leave. So I think the way that we can structure it is Simeon meets them, he says his thing, they get into the Court of the Women, Anna says her thing, they then progress into the Court of the Israelites, they offer the offering, then they go home. Now, if you're trying to figure out where Simeon met them, there's a few different possibilities. You have down there the stairs on the left-hand side. That today is known as Robinson's Arch, not because there were any Robinsons back then, but because a guy with the last name of Robinson found it, right, or discovered it. So it's possible that Simeon met them there. They could have been coming from that side. An area has just recently been excavated known as the Pilgrimage Road. And so people who were coming to Jerusalem, they would meet at the Pool of Siloam. They would wash, which is probably one of the predecessors to baptism, right? So they would wash, they would go up the pilgrimage road, they would walk up the stairs. Now, I actually tend to favor a different idea. If you look on the right-hand side there, that's the east, and you might recall from reading some of the prophecies that what side is Messiah expected to come back to? The east, right? He's expected to come from the east. So to me, it makes sense that one of the ways, one of the signs for Simeon would have been this baby is coming through the eastern gate. It's an interesting possibility. Now, just so you know, so that would be like number 11 right there on the map, the eastern gate. So I think he probably meets them there. We don't really know. Just to add in a little bit of historical interest, this is the eastern gate now. Now, by the way, those stones that you're looking at, those date to about 500 years ago. They're not super ancient. Like 500 years is not very old in Jerusalem time. And you might notice something about the gate. It does not exist, right? Anybody know the history of this? I think this is fascinating. It's a very funny little story. So, Suleiman the Magnificent, he was an Ottoman ruler. He's the guy who builds up these walls in about the 15-ish hundreds. And he hears the prophecies about the Jewish Messiah coming through the Eastern Gate. And he says, aha, I know what to do. I'll stop him. So he does that. And he says, ha, now Messiah can't come. Now, not only that, if you look really closely, you might notice there's also a cemetery in front of it, right? There's also a cemetery in front. And he had heard, Suleiman the Magnificent had heard, that the Jewish Messiah would be a priest, right? So he said, right, priests, according to the Torah, can't touch dead bodies. So I'll bury a bunch of people in front of the door too. See if he can get through that, right? So that's what he does. Now, again, it is really interesting to see that Jews still hold to this idea that Messiah is going to walk through this gate. And so directly opposite of this gate is the Mount of Olives, right? So when Jesus leaves the temple and goes up the Mount of Olives and back and forth, he's constantly going through the Eastern Gate, known as the Golden Gate, no connection to the bridge. And if you look at the Mount of Olives, you will notice that there are thousands of Jews buried on the Mount of Olives, because their belief is when Messiah comes, he will raise the dead and they want to be the first to see him. So I think that's kind of cool. All right. So that's my thought as to where they would have met. You know, we don't know for sure, but I think they probably met Simeon right around 11, met Anna right around 7 in the court of the women. So just to put that together. Now, the story of Luke then ends with this. You can just imagine, I think it's fascinating that this is what we get of most of the Lord Jesus's early life. All right, we have one story, which we'll talk about tomorrow morning, but that. The child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Now, what's crazy to me is that you just think about the things that are contained in this, right? So, like, what does that mean it would have been like to try and teach Christ something? Have you ever thought about that? What would it be like to be his parents and to try and say, okay, here's how you make this, you know? Was he like, well, yeah, and like, you know, made something even better, right? Like, it would have been a funny sort of thing. And I mean, as a dad, I think it would have been incredibly, like, kind of scary to try and be like, okay, let me teach you this kind of spiritual principle. And then he's like, actually, it's like this, right? I mean, that's one of those things where you're like, oh, thanks for teaching me, right? Thanks for explaining that. So it's just a funny sort of thing to think about that's contained in all of this, right? He's growing, he's becoming strong, filled with wisdom, with the favor of God on him. So that's the story of Anna, right? This is where it happened. Let's try and understand a little bit then of this trust piece. Now, the way that Anna is introduced is very interesting. As I said, there's less really said about her than we get from some of the other characters, but we also get something said about her that's not said about the others. So take a look. We're told a very specific piece of information. Now, you might be thinking, oh, I know. It's her tribe. And, well, that sort of fits, but we do know Zechariah and Elizabeth's tribe, right? What do we know about Anna that we don't know about the others? You could say she's a prophetess, but I mean, I feel like that one's kind of cheating. Like, you know, and Zechariah becomes a prophet, so not quite. If you look at all these different verses here for the introduction of Zechariah and Elizabeth, you look at the introduction in verse 27 of Joseph and Mary, if you look at the introduction of Simeon in verse 25, one of the things that you'll notice is, well, maybe you won't notice because it's not there, we don't know their parents or their age. Ooh! Well, Zechariah and Elizabeth are old. Anyway, we'll see. I'll think about that one. I may modify this. All right, so if you take a look at this, it says in verse 36, there was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel, right? So this is her father. Now, when we have things like this that are different, the question we ask is, why? Yes, right? Why is this like this? Why are we told her father? Because ultimately, really, who actually cares who her dad was? I don't say that to be rude, but I mean, I don't know him, right? It's not like you're going to read this and be like, oh yeah, Phanuel, right. Good to know. You know, that's not going to happen. So like, why does it say that? There's got to be a particular reason. Now, once again, you might recall in the last class, we talked about how names sometimes get a little bit mixed up. So I'd like to take a look at this name. I have it in the Greek for you. It's Phanuel, which may help a little bit. It's a Hebrew word, right? Because she's Jewish. So her father's name in the Hebrew is actually Penuel. Does that sound more familiar? Penuel? Now, it means face of God. So I would suggest to you that people wouldn't generally name their children that just because they thought the meaning was cool, because you could maybe kind of struggle with, like, a little bit of blasphemy in that sense of naming your child face of God. But it happens to be a place name as well, right? What happens at a place called Penuel? Yes, I hear the whisperings. So I would put to you that it's important to know who her father is, because there's actually significance in this name, right? As we read this record, the biblical text wants us to be thinking about this place. Now, the place is Penuel. Now, if you're thinking, wait a minute, that says Peniel again, guess what? It's another one of those weird translation pieces. It's the same word, Penuel, Peniel, same thing. So what we see happening at Penuel is this is where Jacob wrestles with God. And that's why he gives the place the name, the face of God, because he's wrestling with God. Now, the big lesson of Penuel is Jacob learning to trust. Do you remember the most faithful moment of Jacob's life? At least according to Hebrews 11, the one that's chosen? Right? What is it? Jacob blessed the sons of Joseph and he leaned on the top of his staff. Now, I don't know about you, but I feel like I generally don't see people leaning on staves and think that's very faithful. And, you know, that's not to say anything against anybody who does that, but that's, you know, that's just not what first comes to mind. Now, for Jacob, that was incredibly faithful, because leaning on his staff meant he couldn't lean on himself anymore. That was the big idea here. His hip is put out of joint, and thus he ends up limping, and he's using this staff. So consistently throughout the biblical text, Penuel shows up a few different times, and I think it's consistently connected to this idea of trusting, right? So you have Penuel, the men of Penuel in Judges chapter 8, they don't want to help Gideon, and instead they trust in their tower. In 1 Kings chapter 12, you have Jeroboam, which I would suggest to you, you can debate me on this, and that's okay, and you know, maybe I'm wrong. But in 1 Kings chapter 12, you have the story of Jeroboam. And I think Jeroboam actually starts out good. He's given a pretty good opportunity in 1 Kings 11, where God says, I'll give you a sure house. So I think he begins by building Shechem, which is the place of renewing vows. That's good. And then he's going to build Penuel as well, which is where Jacob learned to trust. So you have Penuel being connected to trust. And so I'd suggest this is our first piece here of seeing Anna connected to trust. The fact that her father's name is brought out, and nobody would even know who that was, especially considering Luke is writing to Gentiles, right? So nobody would have known who Penuel was. And yet the idea is you're supposed to be thinking about this place and trust. Now, we see trust connected to Anna in a number of different places. Now, before I get into this idea of being a prophetess, meaning huge trust in God, I'd like to just draw out for you. This is the beginning, I think, of a theme that comes out in Luke. And now that we can see it here, we can actually look backwards and see it as well, that Luke is consistently showing women as well as men learning to trust, learning to follow. And this appears to be a very purposeful sort of thing. So you'll notice these declarations of God's goodness. You have Mary's song and Zechariah's prophecy. You have prophets who are recognizing Christ. You have Anna and you have Simeon. And this is an emphasis of Luke's. In Luke chapter 4, you might remember the Lord Jesus goes into the synagogue, and this is where he says, Elijah, there were many widows, right? And Elijah was only sent to the widow in Tyre and Sidon. I'd say the widow of Zarephath. So anyway, you can go through and you can note Luke seems to have this emphasis on what women are doing and women believing. And the reason that I think that that's important is because I would suggest it's not an accident that Luke specifically notes Anna as a prophetess. Right? That's a very important piece of information here. And I'd like to back us up a little bit historically to understand why being a prophetess meant a huge trust in God. My suggestion, you can see what you think about this, but there's not a lot of prophetesses biblically, right? There's very few. So we know that this is a very rare kind of thing. Now, in addition to this, I think in that historical time period, see what you think about this, in that historical time period, that would have actually been a very difficult thing to convince people of as well. For Anna to be able to say, look, I've been chosen by God to be a prophetess, I think there would have been a lot of pushback for something like that. So let me show you what I mean. Now, we've talked about the Mishnah, so take a look at this, right? We're going to create some of our historical context here. So this is Mishnah Ketubot. Here's what it says. These are the kinds of work which the woman is obligated to do for her husband. She grinds and bakes and washes clothes. She cooks and nurses her child. She makes his bed and work with wool. Which, by the way, that's not a typo. That's what it says. If she brought in one maidservant from her father's home, she does not need to grind, bake, or wash. If she brought him two maidservants, she does not need to cook nor nurse her child. Three, she does not need to make his bed nor work with wool. Four, she may sit in an easy chair. Rabbi Eliezer says... So here's Rabbi Eliezer. You're going to notice Rabbi Eliezer has a little bit of some issues here. Rabbi Eliezer says, even if she brought him 100 maidservants, he may force her to work with wool as idleness leads to licentiousness. Now, one of the things that you're going to notice is that there is this feeling at that time that men are not inherently evil, but women are. Now, again, I'm not trying to say anything, I want to be very careful here, not trying to say anything about that being right, right? That is wrong. But it's important for us to understand the historical context that we're looking at here, right? Anna being a woman and being a prophetess, this would have been very challenging. People would have said things like, wait, why are you not cooking? Why are you not making your husband's bed? Now, I know that she was a widow, but you get the idea. Right? This is the Talmud now. So that was the Mishnah, right? Now here's the Talmud commentary. Here's Rabbi Eliezer again. He's going to get a little more extreme. The Gemara cites another question posed to Rabbi Eliezer. A wise woman asked Rabbi Eliezer, since all bore equal responsibility for the incident of the golden calf, due to what factor were their deaths not equal? Now, just to back up and understand what she's talking about here, she's saying, look, everybody sinned at the golden calf. So why didn't everybody have the same consequence? Well, look at what he says, right? This is, I mean, the Gemara says, this is a wise woman, right? This is a good question. But here's the outlook of the day. Some of the people were killed by the sword of Moses and the Levites. Some were killed in a plague. Others were struck with an intestinal illness. He said to her, there is no wisdom in a woman except weaving with a spindle. And so it states, and any woman who is wise-hearted spun with her hands. Therefore, it is unbefitting for a woman to concern herself with such questions. Right? Don't talk to me about this. Go knit something, is what he says. Right? Like, it's pretty crazy to read something like that. Okay, now, I don't know if you've ever looked at this either. There's actually two Talmuds. There's the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud, weirdly enough, was not written in Jerusalem. It was written in Palestine outside of Jerusalem. And the Babylonian Talmud was written in Babylon. That one's considered more authoritative. But sometimes, every once in a while, you get the same stories. So I would like to point out to you, the Jerusalem Talmud tells the same story about Rabbi Eliezer, but it goes a little differently. A lady asked Rabbi Eliezer, why did one sin of the golden calf lead to three different kinds of death? Right, same question. He said to her, the wisdom of a woman is only in her spinning rod. As it is written, all wise women spin with their hands. His son, Hyrcanus, said to him, in order to not give her an answer, you made me lose 300 kor of tithes every year. So apparently people got mad, right, when Rabbi Eliezer said this. He answered, he's not going to give up any ground though. He answered him, may the words of the Torah be burned and not be delivered to women. After she had left, his student said to him, Rabbi, this one you pushed away with a stick, what do you explain to us? Right? We're men. Tell us what actually you believe about this. Now that's crazy. Burn the Torah instead of teach it to a woman, right? But this is the atmosphere that we are looking at. Now this is the Babylonian behavior, or not behavior, the Babylonian Talmud, right? And I'd like to show you the rest of the debate. So this story again shows up and there's more debate on it. The Mishnah states, from here, Ben Azai states, a person is obligated to teach his daughter Torah. So you can see that it is a debate, right? He says, you need to teach your daughter. So that if she drinks and does not die immediately, she will know that some merit of hers has delayed her punishment. He's talking about some weird ritual where, like, if she happens to drink something and doesn't immediately keel over, you know that for some reason she ended up alive, maybe because of studying Torah or something good like that. Now, this guy gets totally, like, knocked over by Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer says, anyone who teaches his daughter Torah is teaching her promiscuity. The Gemara asks, could it enter your mind to say that teaching one's daughter Torah is actually teaching her promiscuity? Right? Like, what? Rather say, it is considered as if he taught her promiscuity. Now, you might have read that and thought, oh, good job, Gemara, right? Like, you're standing up for this. But no, actually, the Gemara is standing up for the Torah, right? It says, you can't say teaching her Torah is teaching her promiscuity, because the Torah is not promiscuity, if that's what you're teaching. Instead, you are teaching her to be promiscuous, but you're not teaching her promiscuity. It wants to make sure that everybody knows that distinction there. Rabbi Abahu says, what is the reason for Rabbi Eliezer's statement? It is, as it is written, I, wisdom, dwell with cunning, Proverbs 8, verse 12, which indicates that once wisdom enters into a person, cunning enters with it. And remember, as they believed, women were innately evil. So if you get cunning entered into the woman, guess what's going to happen? Promiscuity. Rabbi Eliezer fears that women will use the cunning she achieves by learning the wisdom of the Torah to engage in promiscuous behavior. This is what Rabbi Yehoshua is saying, right? A woman desires to receive the amount of a kav of food and with it a sexual relationship, i.e. her husband's availability to fulfill her sexual desires, rather than 9 kav of food and with it abstinence. And since her desires are of a sexual nature, it is undesirable for her to study Torah. In other words, they are inclined towards promiscuity, and you can't feed that, right? If they get any wisdom, bad things will happen. So that was the way that people felt about things. And you can actually see this in the New Testament, right? Have you noticed this? Things went so far, it wasn't just with the teaching piece, but that whole idea that during the woman's time of month, she's unclean, right? As the Torah states, that fences were put around that as well. I'm not going to take you through those, but I'll explain it to you. It was said that you couldn't go near a woman, right, when she was unclean like that. So therefore, how would you know? Right? If you're not supposed to go near them while they're unclean like that, you have a few options, none of which are like real pleasant. So, you know, what are you going to do? So what the rabbi said is, okay, we figured it out. Here's the solution. You're not going to go and ask everybody, right? So instead, what you should do is just men should never be near women. That's, you know, you wonder, like, how did they ever have children? Like, but that's the thing. Like, there's all kinds of stories within the Talmud about how men should never be near women. So for instance, there's a story in which there's a very, very proper rabbi, and he is well respected by everybody, and all of a sudden, he dies. So this widow is trying to figure out why did this happen, right? Why did my husband die like this? So she's praying about it, and all of a sudden Elijah appears. Now this is a thing that happens in the Talmud. Elijah pops up in a lot of places. And so Elijah pops up and she says, Elijah, why did this happen to me? And Elijah says, well, let's, you know, go through different reasons. Number one, what happened during your time of month? And, you know, these are the kind of weird questions that Elijah asks. So she says, well, you know, we did share a bed, but he never touched me. And then she says, oh, you know what? There was a moment where he rolled over and his hand touched mine. And Elijah says, blessed be the Almighty who struck your husband down because he touched you during that time of month, right? Like, so this is the big thing. Yeah, I'm for real in this. Like, I'm not making this story up. So this is the kind of stuff that you see back then. Now, the reason that is so important is to just, because it's very different than today. Like, there's stories about how far, if you're a man, how far behind a woman you're allowed to walk. Because, like, if she accidentally stops, right, and you're not paying attention and you walk into her, then you have to die, right? Like, it's a really, like, crazy kind of thing. Because, you know, you don't know, is she going to be unclean because it might be her time of month? Like, it's pretty outrageous. This is why, because women aren't supposed to be taught these things, because women are unclean, like, this is why, when you look at John chapter 4, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, it's somewhat obscured in the KJV. The KJV says, this is with the woman at the well, Samaritan woman. KJV says, his disciples marveled that he spoke with the woman. The word "the" is not there. It should say, and you'll notice the more modern versions say this, it should say, his disciples marveled that he spoke with a woman. Because if you were a man, you didn't do that. Because if you were talking to a woman, that meant you were close to her. You might accidentally teach her Torah, and you never know what kind of promiscuous things she might do. Or you might accidentally touch her, and then you couldn't be alive anymore. So there's like, it's pretty crazy to understand this whole context back then, right? And I'm like hammering this because it's so foreign to us. And we don't think like this. And so we don't understand that when Luke says, Anna's a prophetess, that's a big deal. And it would have been incredibly difficult for her to come and say, look, here's this message from God, because people would have said, who's been teaching you? What? You were never supposed to learn anything like this. And so to express that she is a prophetess and to have a message to try and share, that would have been a really, really big thing. So I want to just underline that idea of being a prophetess, that required a huge trust in God. Now, in addition to that, remember our two paths that we've been seeing throughout the Luke record. We have seen law and life under law, and then we have seen grace. And I just think it's awesome here to notice that Anna's name, by the way, is the Greek form of Hannah, right? So actually in Greek, it's pronounced Hannah. So there actually is that H sound there. It's Chana in Hebrew, and it's your word grace. So like the name John, Yohanan, right? Hear that? Hanan. That's Chana, the name Chana. So Anna and John have very, very similar names. John's name just includes the name of God as well. Yah is grace, whereas Anna's name just means grace. So again, I hope that you see this theme, right? Here she is. She's learning to trust. She's emphasizing trust. She's emphasizing grace. Now, the last piece to understand is the whole Asher thing. She comes from the tribe of Asher. Now, if we want to give a significance to the tribe of Asher, I don't think we're really going to find it in the New Testament, because Asher, the only other place it ever shows up is Revelation 7:6, and that's just a list of the 12 tribes. So there's nothing super significant about Asher there. So what I'd like to do then is actually back up and try and understand, what is the name Asher? Where does it come from? And what do we know about the tribe of Asher? Because again, for some reason, it's important that we know that she's from Asher. So here's when Asher is named. The name Asher, it's actually Asher, and it means blessed or happy. And you can see how that comes from the verse, from the circumstances. Now, when different prophecies are given, so Jacob gives his prophecy of Genesis 49, Moses gives his prophecy of Deuteronomy 33, these are the things that are said about Asher. So this is really the next time that Asher shows up. Genesis 49:20 says, Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. Deuteronomy 33, verses 24 to 25 says, and of Asher he said, most blessed of sons be Asher. Let him be the favorite of his brothers. Let him dip his foot in oil. Your bars shall be iron and bronze, and as your days, so shall your strength be. Now, you may notice, by the way, that in Deuteronomy 33, there's actually a play on words. Most blessed of sons. That literally says the most Asherish of sons is Asher, right? So he's the most blessed of the children, the most Ashered of the kids. Okay, so those are two places where Asher shows up. And what's interesting about this is neither of those have happened. There is no time in Scripture where you can look at the territory of Asher and say, well, there you go, Asher's rich. Asher has yielded royal delicacies. Asher has been the favorite of the brothers. He's had bars of iron and bronze. None of those things. In fact, when you trace Asher through, you actually see that the story of the tribe of Asher is pretty lame. Look at this. Here's what happens. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or of Alab, or of Aksib, or of Helba, or of Aphek, or of Rehob. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Right? So the tribe doesn't do so good, right? Like the person Asher, you know, that's great because the name means blessed, happy, but the tribe doesn't do what it should do. It's like a whole list of all the people they should drive out, and they didn't. Now then, they're a little wishy-washy as well when you work through the period of Judges. So you'll find out that when Deborah and Barak are fighting, Asher gets invited, and Asher's kind of like, meh, I don't think I need to be involved. Right? Asher sat still at the coast of the sea, staying by his landings. Now, by contrast, Asher does get involved with Gideon. So you can see that there. Judges 6:35, Judges 7:23. So there's some battles that they don't fight, some battles that they do. The Gideon piece is probably because that's the territory of Asher up there that I circled in the red. And you'll notice that Gideon and his battles were fought very close by. So it could have been like a defending the home turf sort of thing. What's weird to think about is, what if Asher had conquered all the territory? Do you see what city would not have been a problem? Tyre, right? This is where Jezebel comes from, Tyre and Sidon. So Asher could have prevented a lot of problems if they had taken the inheritance, but they didn't take it fully. Now, Anna ends up being from Asher centuries and centuries and centuries later, and she's part of Asher even after the 10 tribes are gone. So we have to try and figure out, where does she come from? Well, there's, I think, two possibilities. 2 Chronicles 11:16, there's a mass exodus of the 10 tribes when Jeroboam sets up his whole new priesthood. So it's possible that her family left then. 2 Chronicles 30, verses 10 to 12 also notes, I tend to think it's this one, also notes that people from the tribe of Asher came down to celebrate Hezekiah's Passover. So there were still people from the tribe of Asher even after the northern kingdom was taken, and I tend to think that's probably what you're looking at there. They probably came down at that point in time. We don't really know. Whatever it is, the tribe of Asher really disappears, right? When you look at what Ezra and Nehemiah, how they describe the nation that comes back, it's only ever described as Judah and then sometimes Benjamin. So Judah and sometimes Benjamin, because Benjamin was with them, but there's never "and the remnant of Asher" or something along those lines. So we would get the impression that Asher's totally gone and that's that. So that's really the story. But what's funny about it is, as I said, the prophecies of Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33 didn't get fulfilled. Now, if you take a look at that prophecy there, Genesis 49:20, it's pretty short and sweet. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. That word "rich" shows up in Nehemiah 9 and verse 25. The reason I want to bring that out is because it's talking about the land. With the land, the inheritance was rich. In other words, when it says there, Asher's food shall be rich, what it's saying is Asher would inhabit the land. They would have that land. And as we said, that didn't happen at that point in time. Now, we can see that, in fact, it is going to happen, because if you go through some of the prophecies like Isaiah 30, that word "rich," I've underlined it for you on the slides, that word "rich" shows up again in relation to the land in the kingdom of God. So it will be fulfilled. Eventually, Asher's land will be rich. Now, as far as the royal delicacies go, your phrase there in the Hebrew is ma'adanei melech. Ma'adanei melech, which translates to delicacies of a king. Now, you can perhaps understand a little bit of what's going on there in the prophecy, that the prophecy is saying there's going to be a king. So in other words, we have future prophecies of the land and future prophecies of this king. Now, in Deuteronomy 33, we're reading that Asher will be the blessed, the most blessed of all the brothers. I think what's awesome about this is we see a fulfillment of this in Anna. I think this is why we are specifically told she's of the tribe of Asher. Here it is. Just think about this. The prophecy of Genesis 49 was made in approximately, what, 1800 BCE? Here it is, almost 2,000 years later, being fulfilled. I feel like you could just picture people saying, well, there you go, Genesis 49, that's not going to happen. Deuteronomy 33, that one, that only happened, you know, about 1400 BCE. People say, well, there you go, that's not going to happen. And yet, here you have it, almost 2,000 years later, being fulfilled. This is why Anna's all about trust. This is why Anna is this picture of someone who is standing against what everybody else says. No, you can't do that. No, you can't be a prophetess, right? Like, women don't learn Torah. That can't be a thing. You couldn't have been chosen by God to do that, right? That couldn't be a thing. So, I think what we see is trust over and over and over. So, all throughout Anna's story, this is the emphasis. She trusts. She trusts. Now, I'd like to just wrap it up by considering this widow piece. Now, Anna's a widow, as it says. And again, I think we don't often think about what life was like for widows at that point in time. So they had a few different options. So under the law, there was the levirate marriage, meaning that if their husband died, they could marry the husband's brother, right? Anna doesn't appear to do that. So that doesn't seem to be one of those options. She has one husband and that's it. Now, strangely enough, I don't know how much you know about this historically, so I'll just share this. Historically, widowhood often meant that you turned to prostitution to survive. So that's a piece of just the history there. Now, obviously she doesn't do that either, but I think it's important to understand what she may have tried to figure out, right? You know, what can I do here? How do I survive? Now, another option for a widow was not levirate marriage, but just being married again, right? This whole idea of if the husband dies, another man can take her. So that was another possibility, but again, it's one that Anna didn't take. Okay. Oh, I told you I wouldn't skip any slides. Sorry. I thought this was already sort of understood. But this is just saying that back in the first century, it was understood that there was no issue with a widow remarrying. Right? So that's what the Talmud's saying there. Now then, part of the struggle was the reason that this remarriage would often happen was because, as we talked about before, children were your retirement plan. Now, what ends up happening through things like the Mishnah is that whole setup, that safety net for women, gets messed up. Instead of their children taking care of them, there was this whole idea of korban, meaning you didn't have to take care of your parents. Instead, you could say, oh, actually, I'm devoting, that's what the word korban means, I'm devoting everything that I would have given to my parents, I'm devoting that to God. And so, therefore, your parents wouldn't be taken care of, and you would instead give that to the temple. And you can see that Christ says, that's not okay, you missed the point of the law. So, as far as Anna goes, there were some different options. She could have gotten remarried, she could have gone through the levirate marriage, she doesn't do those things. And so, her situation, I'd suggest, is somewhat astonishing. Like, it's pretty rare to have a woman who maybe is taken care of by kids, but I mean, it doesn't really sound like she has any. So, like, what's she do? How does this happen? What's going on here? Well, what's really amazing about it, I think, is that not only is she in a different situation like this than maybe we might expect, but the Apostle Paul actually seems to build his case on true widows. He seems to build it on Anna. Listen to this. Honor widows who are truly widows. Okay, so what does that mean? What is a true widow? Well, in verse 16, he explains, if any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened so that it may care for those who are truly widows. In other words, a true widow in this context is somebody who has no relatives, no family. Okay, so that appears to be Anna. When you look at her story, there's no children, there's no husband, anything along those lines. And you'll notice then that the rest of this section seems to be built on her story. Luke 2:36 says that she lived with her husband and then was a widow, right? 1 Timothy 5:9, the wife of one husband. So she only had one husband. She was not married again. Luke 2:37 says until she was 84. Well, Paul specifically says that these true widows can't be less than 60 years old. Luke 2:37 says that she worshiped with fasting and prayer night and day, and 1 Timothy 5:6 says that true widows will continue in supplications and prayers night and day. So I think it's based off of Anna's story. Paul says, she who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day, but she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. Where did Anna come from? How did she take care of herself? I would suggest to you that she set her hope on God, as Paul says. And he's building this case off of the story of Anna. And what he's saying here is that Anna trusted that as a prophetess, as someone called to this work, that God would take care of her. This is why it says, essentially, that she lived in the temple. And I think that's why her story then parallels, or her description parallels the description of some other people too. She did not depart from the temple, worshiping with fasting and prayer night and day. Who else did that? 1 Chronicles 9:33 says, now these, the singers, the heads of fathers' houses of the Levites, were in the chambers of the temple, free from other service, for they were on duty day and night. Psalm 34:1-2. About the Levites says, come bless the Lord, all you servants of the Lord, who stand by night in the house of the Lord. Lift up your hands to the holy place and bless the Lord. The Levites and the priests were those who were in the temple continually. They were working there day and night, day and night. And thus, Anna's story parallels that. Now, here's where I think it gets really exciting for us, because Luke doesn't let that go, but look at how he ends his gospel. There's another group of people like that. Luke 24, verse 52. And they worshiped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy and were continually in the temple blessing God. Same kind of thing for the disciples. They had to figure out, how are we going to survive? Who's going to take care of us while we do this work? Now, I'm not suggesting that that's what we all need to do. I think we have to figure out how this principle applies in each of our individual lives. Now, the point is, the principle is that God is looking for that exceptional trust. That here's Anna, she's waiting, she's devoted her life to this. This is everything for her. And so for us, that principle is, how much of our lives are the Lord Jesus? How much have we given? How much is consumed by the work of the gospel? How much have we been inspired to trust? Because when we recognize that the Lord Jesus is exceptional, when we recognize that we need grace, we can't just sit there and say, wow, I'm so glad that grace exists. We have to be inspired by what God has done, inspired by how much we don't deserve, and inspired by how good he is, and therefore say, I trust you, and I'm going to give it all.